passage. "I'm not going to be here much longer," Mom says as we sit over her teak kitchen table, the wood barely visible under the mounds of 8x11-inch paper, bank and investment statements, letters, bills. Early morning light falls like a whisper over her thin silver-white hair, her lined forehead the color of walnut shells, and the relaxed skin under her chin. She lifts the blue Wedgwood cup of coffee to her lips. "You don't know that," I counter. "Yes, I do. What I mean is that the bulk of my life as a normal person is over." I have no reply. It's February, winter in Atlanta, a compassionate version. No whipping wind, and the cold does not tremble your bones. Through the window, I see a few leftover brown leaves swirling over the grounds and walkways of her apartment complex. This is Mom's city, not the one she was born and grew up in, but the international metropolis it grew into and where she kept returning. Betty has been trying to get me to take an antidepressant because she thinks I'm depressed, and I am, but I don't want to take another pill. I sip my Earl Grey tea, and for a moment, the waft of bergamot pleases. The conversation began when I noted she seemed unhappy about having agreed last month to see a neurologist. My daughter Maia, an anesthesiologist, suggested it to me. She's in Atlanta now, signed on to do two fellowships at a hospital near Mom, where she heard a neurologist speak about the importance of early intervention in dementia. Maia is in her 30s, petite, focused, and warm-mannered. Her patients are often astonished when she introduces herself as their doctor, her face one of an ingenue. Mom adores her. Having Maia present the idea of a consultation was our best shot at getting Mom's cooperation. Maia got the names of two neurologists and offered to make the appointment. I agreed to get the referral from Mom's primary care doctor. But somehow, now that I'm here in Mom's apartment and on her phone trying to reach her doctor, an ugly scowl takes hold of her face. Growing up, I shrank under the power of that look. And even now, it unsettles. "I don't understand, Mom," I say finally. "You do all these things to keep as much quality as you can in your life in terms of your physical health. Take medicines for your blood pressure, bladder, your heart, walk for an hour almost every morning, and keep your doctor appointments." "That's right. I'm trying to do everything I can to be able to function as long as I can." Her voice is taut, determined as I've known her, and yet there's a looser tension finally threaded through it. "Well, according to Maia, there may be some medication that can help slow the progression of your memory loss if given early on. I just don't see why you wouldn't want to try to do the same thing for your cognitive health." Silence. "I said I'll go. I'm just tired of doctors." Weariness dims her eyes and drags her cheeks in. I cannot ask for more. I continue to sip my tea and she refills her cup. In the silence that hovers, my mind loops back over the terrain we've traveled. 7 years since Mom's laser surgery for bladder cancer, and 9 years since the death of her husband of 34 years. Only 3 months after her scalpel surgery for colon cancer, no chemo advised. 19 years in retirement from being a full professor. Her ears or neck rarely adorned now, her feet no longer in high heels. These days it's sweatsuits or jeans and one of my stepfather's long shirts, today's attire. But she can still dial it up when the occasion arises, like the dinner 4 years ago celebrating her Volunteer of the Year award given by a local TV station. Didn't she look sharp in that photo? Her hair softly curled, falling to her shoulders, that silver-toned chain with the small rectangles at intervals looped twice over her cobalt blue dress. I see other favorites of hers, her black alligator pumps and the pastel yellow clip-on earrings that fan out in four petals of a flower. Precious jewels, too, the jade ring with a gold band and the black pearl set on white gold. Bounty collected during a professional trip to Japan. I remember hearing her voice nearly in song over the phone. I'm signing up for a computer class, she says, 13 years into retirement, and a tide of admiration washes over me. It's one of our Sunday phone calls, bridging the geography between us when I'm home, just outside New York City. We catch each other up on the week. Her computer and username, Foxy May, arriving. Laughing and loving to see it appear as I scroll a screen of emails. May is her middle name, not uncommon for black girls, especially those named after their fathers. Johnny May, my great aunt always called her. I'm thrilled to have a mom her age sending emails, her hunger to learn undiminished. We have 3 good years with Foxy May before a sad cumulus cloud floats inside me as her memory of how to get into her email or to log on begin to fail. I suspect one drifts in her too, but we never share this. Flights to Atlanta becoming more frequent as I witness the mounting mail she cannot sift through or discard, the periodic disorientation at sundown, and the need for me to yell and repeat myself. Patience forced into me as I listen to the same stories again and again. Kindness flowering as I behold the fragility of life in this formidable woman from whom I've learned so much. To be feminine and powerful, to nurture my intellect and persevere, to focus on what's important and not be fooled by nonsense, no matter how well it's dressed. A mobile phone showing up for a much shorter run. Can you show me how to use the cell phone? She asks at every visit I make for a while. I do, each time, then say, you have to use it, Mom, in order to remember. But it isn't that simple. Now at 86, she is an outlier in her family. Her dad and sister, her only sibling, dropped dead. He at 63 and she at 59. Mom's mom died at 40 from cancer or the surgery in her doctor's office. We can't be sure. Jim Crow did not permit my grandmother to be admitted to her white doctor's hospital. Mom was 16. A ringing phone pierces my reverie. My mind rejoins the kitchen, feels the chair seat holding my bottom. My cup is empty of Earl Grey. I hope it's the doctor's office, but it's not. It's Mom's friend Betty, a happy hour invitation. I retreat to the guest bedroom with my favorite bed, a king-sized one that holds my slumbering body with perfection. I sit down on it and breathe. So much has changed. Minutes later, I make my way down the carpeted hall again. The light is on in the bathroom, but no Mom. As a girl, turn the light off when you leave the room, got imprinted on my brain. As I reach in to flip the switch, I see the water running and a toothbrush topped with toothpaste resting on the sink. As I round my way into the kitchen, the scent of bacon frying ignites a longing for the taste. But images of fat clumping on the blood vessels or my hips kill the urge. Mom is making her breakfast lunch, the BLT that has become her daily standard. She seems to eat less now, but her weight holds steady as it always has, with rare exception. Growing up, hard-boiled eggs on her plate signal a few extra pounds were going. Her degree in food chemistry meant she prioritized a balanced, healthy diet and moderation, but now she seems not to care about bacon every day. I don't mention the bathroom scene. At times, her rigidity annoys me. Half the dining room table is also covered in an avalanche of paper, 12-inch high piles now. During a previous visit, I discovered some are empty envelopes I'm sure I can throw them out. But no, Mom says she must check to ensure they are indeed empty. At this visit, she clears me to open envelopes that aren't charity requests, leaving the bulk of the stacks for her to sort through. But more and more, I get tearful hearing her excitement when my voice comes through the phone. Dee! Like a child getting a big bag of M&Ms. Oh, and she says to me, her face forlorn during a visit, I want you to know I really do appreciate your coming to visit me. She's as definitive as a cleaver in rejecting the idea of moving to New York, leaving her doctors, her city. So I have begun to look for employment in Atlanta. Once before I told her I was moving there, but as time moved closer, I realized I did not want to uproot. Now I will not tell her until it's a done deal. It's early summer, 4 months from my obtaining the referral from her internist, when Maya and I accompany her to get the neuropsychologist's test results and the neurologist's recommendation. It's official, dementia and medication. Not unexpected, but getting the ICD code is like being pinned. Mom does not protest. The transitions before me are not unique, I know. Yet the fact that they're universal and part of life matters as much to me as cocktail party chit-chat. What I treasure are tiny pearls that appear in mundane surroundings, a particular moment between particular people. An expression. I'm proud of your two children. I'm proud of you too, between my mom and me in her living room. A feeling. Arising between my mom and a woman with a thick German accent wearing a hairnet. She's a star, Mom says, beaming, when she rejoins me in the hall of the senior high-rise. She's delivered the Meals on Wheels food to her in her apartment. She's always friendly and the only one in her family here. She showed me lots of pictures of her relatives in her living room. An action taken by Ruth, Mom's neighbor across the hall, who's living and dying with lung cancer, a woman who paid for her own funeral a couple weeks ago and brought Mom Crowder peas, my favorite, for her to fix for me, a Southern meal. A girlish tenor in Mom's voice when she tells me that since she's been on the new medication, her mother has been coming in her dreams, more vivid than ever, to help her. I think it's more than a dream. I think her spirit is visiting you. It's so good to see her. This is medicine to me. The comfort it brings Mom and the reaffirmation of ancestors as resources. Beyond Meals on Wheels on Fridays, Mom helps prepare cheese grits and bacon and serve Sunday morning breakfast to the homeless at a church community program created by a pastor, her friend. Midweek, she volunteers at a nonprofit for the working poor in crisis. She listens to stories of need for rent money, for getting electricity back on or keeping it from going off, and for food. In retirement, she's shape-shifted, leaving behind amino acids to take up human service delivery, especially for those failed by societal institutions. She's recreated a life of purpose. In September, the first one after her diagnosis, Mom phones. I fell and hit my head. When? 4 or 5 days ago. I'm having trouble with my balance. 4 or 5 days ago? Did it bleed? Does it still hurt? Why didn't you say anything? I didn't hit it hard. No blood. Some remaining tenderness, no symptoms. But I've stopped walking in the mornings in the past few days. My stomach drops, struck with the sound of air abandoning the balloon of her life day by day. Sober with the understanding there is no going back, no pump that can restore her round, colorful fullness. I'm sorry, you've reached a number that is no longer in service and has been disconnected. The recording kicks in after the second ring, A jolt of panic runs through me in New York until I speak with a Southern Bell rep. My list of online bill payments stretches to include Mom's. She doesn't fight me. But the pressure is building from Maia, who has begun to call Mom at night to ask if she's remembered to turn off the stove after hearing she forgot one night. You have to get her some help. Someone to come into her apartment to check on her, Maia says to me. Even if I could get someone to come in for a few hours a day, what would they do? They can't just watch her. And most of all, Mom doesn't agree. I don't need anyone coming in here, is akin to her response to the concerns I've voiced for nearly a year about her continuing to drive. I'll know when it's time for me to stop. Neither her neurologist or primary doc will say to her, it's time. Dear Spirit, please protect Mom from hurting anyone with her car, including herself, like the elderly California man in the news who hit the accelerator instead of the brake and killed people. May she get a low-cost warning that reaches her. She is still the mother and rules her life. In my 50s, I'm still her child, the only, and cannot match her power. Maia thinks I can or should be able to, but mostly she just wants this worry gone. Her plate is full. But limbo is where we have to live. Dear Spirit, please protect me from stressing from these increased demands, the embroiling conversations. Help me to engage less, not to drive myself crazy, expecting I can do what I can't. It is not all up to me. I will do what I can. Help me see what that is and leave the rest in your hands. I search for a job, write affirmations. I have a job in Atlanta that I like, that allows me to write as though it's already true. I wait. Mom's happy hour visits with Betty and another white-haired friend continue once a week. They live in the same complex. This joy ends too when she falls again, 4 months after the first one. She'd refused to use the cane. Her knee breaks this time and cannot bear weight. The door is suddenly blown open to women strangers coming in to care for her around the clock. Driving is out. The pearls are getting buried. I fear there will be none to brighten her face or light the mounting weight of my grief. Or lighten the mounting weight of my grief. But I am wrong. New pearls appear all the way to the end. The Milky Way that lights Mom's face whenever she sees Maia. The poem an aide writes for me close to the end. And Mom's mischievous whisper in my ear. The room filled with several women. Who's got the biggest butt?